From New England Public Radio in Springfield, Massachusetts, this is NEPR News Now. Stories you really should not miss. Thanks for listening. I'm Sam Hudzik, the news director at New England Public Radio. On this episode, we're about a year out from the MGM Casino's expected opening date in Springfield. There's a lot of unresolved issues, from who's going to benefit from the jobs to how the state is going to help folks avoid addiction. So what's going on with the growing number of casino plans in Connecticut?
The Bridgeport Casino is a long, long, long way from being a reality. And we've learned not to lose too much sleep over things that are highly, highly speculative.
A conversation with Steve Crosby, Massachusetts' top casino regulator. Then, months after opening, the Dr. Seuss Museum in Springfield has still not said how or if it's going to address the author's more controversial drawings from early in his career.
Ted Geisel is an adult cartoonist trafficked in racist stereotypes of all sorts.
Then a Massachusetts craft brewery moves into a much bigger facility but still has super long lines. Its customers don't seem angry.
You see people come in here after work. It's a neat experience, actually.
We look into that neat experience at Treehouse Brewery and whether they can live up to the hype. Plus, a commentary about a cool America.
A young woman with a tattooed sleeve serves a craft beer with my Parmesan truffle fries.
I prefer ketchup with my fries, but the beer sounds good. Okay, lots of beer in this episode, I guess. All that's just ahead on NEPR News Now. But first, 80% of Holyoke, Massachusetts public school students are of Puerto Rican descent. After the island experienced extensive damage from two hurricanes, the district is expecting an influx of new students. New England Public Radio's Jill Kaufman reports.
Students, families, and many school staff in Holyoke are still desperate for news from relatives on the island, with so many homes destroyed and a long-term power outage ahead. Holyoke School Superintendent Stevens Reich says they're getting ready for new arrivals.
We're in constant contact with the relief efforts and that the city has set up and the region has set up so that as they start interfacing with families, they're providing us with information about families that may be coming with children.
Zreich says for now, most new families will be classified as homeless. And under federal guidelines, that means schools must also provide them things like food for the weekends, money for school uniforms. Many students, he says, will come without any records.
Whether it's their IEP records, whether it's their immunizations, that's one thing we're in active discussion about, is how do we get them enrolled as quickly as possible.
Iriana Cintron is coordinating much of this. She's the district's chief of family and community engagement. She says the schools need to be ready to support a variety of scenarios.
You know, is this, you know, a more permanent move? Is it, you know, really temporary?
Puerto Ricans don't necessarily want to leave the island.
People want to rebuild and people want to, you know, make sure they're able to rebuild and to, you know, get the aid that they need in the island.
So while they wait for emergency money and materials, Cintron says adults may stay put and send their kids to Holyoke.
That may mean that some of the kids, you know, may come to live with grandma or with an aunt or with a cousin, you know, for a little while.
Way before the weather disaster hit, Cintron says Puerto Rico's decade-long economic crisis has been causing families to leave. Increasingly, Holyoke has become home to many of them. 75 students from the island just started here in the new school year, and there's room for more in some schools. The district is already in state receivership. Without knowing how many students are coming from Puerto Rico, Superintendent Reich says he doesn't know what extra money they'll need or end up receiving. The best they can do this week is get ready. For New England Public Radio, I'm Jill Kaufman.
Jill, of course, is going to keep on following that story, so stay tuned. Now to a big gamble. This time next year, the nearly billion-dollar MGM Casino in Springfield will be open. That's the company's expectation, at least. And it's certainly the hope of the state's top casino regulator, Steve Crosby. To talk about that timeline and some lingering issues related to the casino, New England Public Radio's Kari Injiri sat down with Crosby and started by asking if he was confident a September 2018 opening is possible.
The short answer would be yes. I mean, we track this very closely. We have a team of people who collaborate with MGM and with their construction people. And we're confident that their estimates so far are correct. They're trying to get everything ready to go to interior work during the winter. And if there was some really, really bad weather that might slow them down, things can always happen. But as the way things are looking now, they look very much on target to open in September of next year.
With regards to hiring, MGM says it expects to hire 3,000 workers. But regulations governing who can work at the casino could potentially rule out many of those with criminal records who really are most in need of a job. When we spoke with you last year, you mentioned that the Gaming Commission was concerned about that as well, and that you had written the legislature asking it to revise the rules specifically for those who would be working in non-sensitive positions. What is the current status? Has the issue been resolved?
It's not been resolved, but the leadership of both the House and the Senate in the legislature have said that this was a mistake. This was not what they intended for the rules to be. It is a mistake to disqualify non-sensitive, what you call non-sensitive or non-gaming employees, because of some kinds of criminal records automatically. That's what happens now. And they say that they will pass an amendment to our statute sometime maybe within the next month to clear this up. And we and others are working very, very hard to urge the legislature to get it done in a month or so.
When it comes to diversity in hiring and construction, has MGM adhered to those diversity goals to the commission's satisfaction?
Again, the answer is yes. And again, we monitor them very, very closely. We have a monthly meeting with them and with their contractors and with labor unions and so forth to make sure that the women and the minorities and veterans goals are met. And in fact, MGM, through the construction phase, has pretty substantially exceeded almost all of their goals, both in employment but also in vendor relationships.
You may be aware that Connecticut signed off recently on a new agreement to allow for a new casino in East Windsor, which is just about 13 miles from Springfield, that would be run by the tribes that own Foxwoods and the Mohegan Sun. And more recently, MGM announced that it would build a casino in Bridgeport, although it has no agreement with the state to build one. Have these developments changed the calculus for the Gaming Commission when it comes to assessing MGM Springfield's future?
Not really. We've always tried to be cautious in our estimates of the kind of revenue that will be generated. We've estimated that amongst the three facilities, the slots parlor, the Wynn Casino, and the MGM Casino here in Springfield, among the three of them, they would generate $250 to $300 million in tax revenue a year. The MGM share of that would be somewhere in the neighborhood of $100 million annually, and we have every reason to think that those are numbers that we can still rely on.
Do you see the announcement of MGM building a casino in Bridgeport as being one that might siphon off its commitment, if you will, to Springfield?
First of all, the Bridgeport Casino is a long, long, long way from being a reality, and we've learned not to lose too much sleep over things that are highly, highly speculative. Having said that, it seems to be pretty much a different market. It's really aiming towards the New York market. It might take away from Mohegan Sun and Foxwoods, but we don't think it would likely have much impact. But as I said, that is so far in the distance that it's hard to spend too much time worrying about it.
We recently aired a story about the Gaming Commission's self-exclusion program, which basically allows people with gambling addictions to ban themselves from casinos and for a set period of time. It's a whole lot easier to sign up right now in Eastern Massachusetts than it is in Western Mass. I'd imagine that getting an office out here is a priority. And if so, how soon should we expect that?
Well, certainly within the next year. Before the casino is open, we hope to have set up an intake system, maybe using community health workers. Maybe it'll just be our own personnel. We're not sure what yet. But we're working with the Department of Public Health to put together a network that will make the voluntary self-exclusion list readily accessible to people. And it will be ready before the casino opens.
Chairman Crosby, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Steve Crosby is chairman of the Massachusetts Gaming Commission. He spoke to New England Public Radio's Kari and Jerry. Let's stay in Springfield. From a highly anticipated casino, expected next year, to a highly anticipated museum that launched this year. Since it opened in June, the Dr. Seuss Museum has attracted thousands of visitors to Springfield. Boosters say it's a win for the local economy and a fitting tribute to Ted Geisel, the city's famous son. But critics have complained that earlier controversial work by Geisel was completely left out of the exhibits. As New England Public Radio's Alden Bourne reports, the museum has not addressed those concerns.
The new Amazing World of Dr. Seuss Museum has murals and statues of some of the author's most famous characters, like Horton the Elephant and the Cat in the Hat. But before Theodore Geisel began writing the children's books that brought him worldwide fame, he drew political cartoons during World War II of the Japanese. They are now thought to be blatantly racist, but are nowhere to be found in the museum. Suzanne Samard of East Longmeadow recently visited with her children. She didn't know about the earlier drawings and was unsure they should be on display.
I guess I'm torn. Maybe you could say that that's part of history, but then on the other hand, it could offend people. So, I don't know. I wouldn't want my children to see something racist.
I think it's a real missed learning opportunity, especially for children.
That's Mia Wengen. She's a Japanese-American who runs a blog about parenting, children's literature, and education called Pragmatic Mom.
I think the important thing is to look at it in context, and to ask questions and to point out where the racism exists and ask children what they think about it.
Shortly after the museum opened, the New York Times interviewed Wengen for an article titled, Oh, the Places They Don't Go, which focused on the omission of Geisel's more controversial drawings. The Times also talked to Philip Nell, an English professor at Kansas State University. He says the museum is presenting an incomplete portrait of the author.
I wish that it had gone more into Seuss's politics, because that's a really important part of who Seuss was as an artist and as a person.
Both early in his career with those political cartoons and later in his children's books.
He wrote The Sneetches as a criticism of anti-Semitism, although it also, of course, works as an anti-racism parable.
The New York Times spoke with the head of Dr. Seuss Enterprises, who defended the decision to leave out the earlier cartoons by saying that the critical distinction is between Dr. Seuss and Mr. Geisel, adding that this is a Dr. Seuss museum. Since the Times article, the Springfield Museums has said little on this subject or how it would address critics' concerns. The director, Kay Simpson, declined our request for an interview. She said in an email that it would be premature to discuss any ideas until they have something more specific to share. A spokeswoman for the Springfield Museums also declined to be recorded, but she encouraged us to speak with Professor Donald Pease at Dartmouth, who is an expert on Dr. Seuss, and it turns out, not exactly a defender of the museum.
I do think they should have included some of his earlier cartoons, insofar as those cartoons appeared under the signature Dr. Seuss.
Pease's job is funded with a grant made by Geisel before his death, but he's hardly an apologist for him.
Ted Geisel is an adult cartoonist trafficked in racist stereotypes of all sorts, directed against African Americans, against Scottish Americans, against Jews.
In one infamous cartoon, Geisel drew Japanese Americans waiting in line for explosives to carry into California, and that cartoon was signed Dr. Seuss. Pease says that soon after, Geisel realized what he'd done, and that his later children's books make his more enlightened mindset clear.
Horton Hears a Who is an explicit act of recantation of the caricatures of the Japanese that he had constructed.
There seems to be confusion about the Seuss Museum's next steps. The Kansas State professor, Nell, said he was invited to a symposium at the museum this fall to discuss Seuss's work. He said that was delayed, maybe to the spring. The museum confirms it postponed a symposium on children's literature to allow time for more planning. As for when it could happen, the museum would only say in the future. For New England Public Radio, I'm Alden Bourne.
The Springfield Museums points out that it did have an exhibit of Seuss's more controversial work at one of its other museums. That was 15 years ago. Now to that beer story. You won't be able to find a cold can or freshly poured draft of Treehouse beer anywhere except where it's made, right in Charlton, Massachusetts. Customers travel near and far to stand in long lines for a taste of Treehouse's New England-style India Pale Ales. But after investing in a new 55,000-square-foot brewery, will the lines last? New England Public Radio's Carson McGrath reports.
Built into the design of Treehouse's new location are a couple of reminders of the brewery's rapid growth.
Hopefully, the first thing you see is our timber frame structure, which is the same dimensions as the timber frame structure that we started in Brimfield when we started in 2011.
Dean Rowan is co-founder of Treehouse.
And etched on the floor, which was a surprise to my other partner and myself, our co-partner, co-founder, etched the footprint of our original brewery on the floor.
6 years and two breweries later, Treehouse now serves 15,000 customers a week. Rowan says they come from all over.
We've had China, Japan, but I know we've had California. You know, I know we've had, I can't imagine a state that hasn't been here.
I'm from New York, New York.
Caroline Eusis made a pit stop at Treehouse on her way home from vacationing on Martha's Vineyard.
It's very family oriented. My little 1-year-old is here running around. He's happy as can be. He's chasing all the dogs. It's really nice. You see people coming here after work. It's a neat experience, actually.
Treehouse hopes to create a unique experience in Charlton, but they are not the only brewery focusing on hyper-local sales. Companies like Trillium in Boston and Rare Barrel in Berkeley, California are doing the same. Treehouse removes a distributor from the equation entirely. Andrew Gill, beer writer for the AV Club, says that puts more money into the brewery's pocket.
I think that they are a model of understanding where the beer industry is going, and these larger breweries are learning from breweries like Treehouse because they understand, you know, how to orient their business in order to be profitable.
Larger breweries like Sierra Nevada, New Belgium, and Oscar Blues expanded by opening bigger facilities in North Carolina to distribute to their East Coast customers. But Gill says the expansion wasn't as successful as the companies hoped.
When they did that, they expected their demand to keep growing at the rate it had been growing, and it hasn't, actually. So a number of those companies have taken investment from private equity firms like Oscar Blues was kind of wholly acquired by the private equity fund. And so now they're not independent anymore.
That independence is exactly where the beer industry is headed, Gill says. Smaller breweries like Treehouse who focus on serving their communities. And that could be what drives the hype. For Treehouse, because its beer is sold at one location, rations are necessary so more customers can leave with some cans. This rarity brings customers in each week with lines anywhere between 10 minutes to over an hour wait. But Brian Roth, director of the North American Guild of Beer Writers, says standing in line for a product isn't a new phenomenon and certainly not unique to beer.
You'll have these lines where people will wait for hours on end, but it's not so much just the end product that they're getting, but it's also that kind of shared experience that helps them to feel like it can be a bit more of an authentic transaction than just handing over your dollars and leaving.
Treehouse insists it's trying to shorten the lines, but keeps drawing in a crowd of customers with food trucks on the weekends, outdoor seating, and even touch football games. And for those super fans wondering if Treehouse will distribute their beer elsewhere, Rowan says maybe, but
our plan really is to stay hyper-local, to keep our beer as close to us as we can so we're able to monitor what happens to it. The further away your beer gets, the less it gets treated well.
That is especially true for Treehouse's beer. Those juicy New England-style IPAs the brewery is known for don't last very long before the freshness fades. Treehouse is hoping its popularity has a longer shelf life. For New England Public Radio, I'm Carson McGrath.
This past summer, commentator Bruce Watson hit the road. He drove a support vehicle for 7 bicyclists who started out from Puget Sound and went up and over the Rockies, across Montana, the Great Plains, and all the way to Boston. While on this tour, Watson also searched for some reassurance about our country. He says he found it.
Since the last presidential election, with all its ugliness, I've wanted to see a kinder America, an America where people work to improve their communities, and a cooler America where people celebrate art, music, and ideas that transcend politics and its malcontents. This summer, the America I found, traveling coast to coast, was even kinder and cooler than I'd expected. I found a cooler America in cities, cities I didn't expect. A unicyclist rides past, juggling. A young woman with a tattooed sleeve serves a craft beer with my Parmesan truffle fries. Several art galleries are having openings tonight, and the average age here, about 25. Had I died and gone to Brooklyn, to Boulder? Nah, it was just another Friday night in Fargo, North Dakota. America's small cities, Fargo and Sandpoint, Idaho, and Bay City, Michigan, are preserving their past while crafting a future bright enough to draw millennials. These cities were already great again. I found a kinder America, too. Strangers stopped my bike group, and upon learning of Charlie Reed, the late son of two cyclists, whipped out a $20, a $50, or once a $100 bill and gave it to the Epilepsy Foundation. No questions asked, no thanks needed. It happened a dozen times. This is all I can afford, many said. There were disturbing sights. Across rural America, nostalgia is the air too many breathe. People are hunkered down in their past. Bar TVs air the Andy Griffith Show. There are classic car rallies, oldies radio, and parades like your grandmother would have watched. Rural America is trying to pretend it's 1959. But young people are fleeing these enclaves, heading for the cool cities whose hope and spirit are the true face of the future. If I had my way, I'd require all Americans to cross the country, overland, at least once. Only by driving through flyover country can you understand the immensity of America, the variety of people, the triumph and tragedy of our history. Travel, Mark Twain wrote, is fatal to prejudice, bigotry, and narrow-mindedness, and many of our people need it sorely on these accounts. Back home now, this traveler agrees.
Bruce Watson lives in Montague, Massachusetts. He's the author of four books on American history and a new blog, The Attic, for a kinder, cooler America. This podcast is produced by New England Public Radio, a listener-supported public media company. Listener, that's you. That brings you news and music and NEPR.net. Check it out. And while you're there, you can make a contribution to New England Public Radio. Click the orange donate button at the top of the screen. Thanks so much for listening. And if you liked what you heard, don't forget to leave a review for NEPR News Now on iTunes. Please. Okay. Until next time.